Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the Courage Conversation Show. I'm your host, Ashley Easter. I am the founder and executive director of Courage 365, and we have a great show planned for you today. If you're not familiar with Courage 365, we are a survivors empowerment organization. We empower advocates and survivors to really live their life in a state of courage. We have helpful resources on our website and all kinds of tools and experts that come on our show. We love to share both survivor stories and from people who are really experts in their field who can give us tips for creating safe environments. And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about safe parenting. And we have an amazing guest. Her name is Cindy Wong Brandt. And I'm going to just, before I bring her on, I'm just going to read her bio really quickly so you can get to know her. But this is going to be such a treat. This is an interview that we've tried to work out for probably a couple years now. And so I'm just so glad that it's finally come together because Cindy has such amazing information. And I know you're going to want to tune in for this. Cindy Wong Brandt is an author, a podcaster, and speaker who helps parents unpack and heal from their religious trauma so they can raise children in safety and gentleness with justice-centered ideals. She was born into an irreligious family but went to a religious school in Taiwan where she converted and spent her formative years in conservative evangelicalism. We're going to be talking about her views on parenting and how we can create safe environments. It's going to be such a good interview. So without further ado, let me welcome Cindy onto the show. Hey, Cindy, welcome to Courage Conversations.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. That was a really nice bio. It's always, I love the work that I do, and I am proud to do what I do to create safe spaces for families.
Absolutely. And I think it's really such an important topic. And so many people focus on children from a perspective of how can we address abuse once it's occurred. And that is important 100%. But I know that you have a passion for prevention and kind of just creating a safe relationship between parents and children from the get-go. So I can't wait to dive in. I've got a couple questions planned for you today. And the first one is just, I have long really been just impressed by your work around unfundamentalist parenting. You have a Facebook group that I've been a part of, and I just love the conversations you have there. And you really have this emphasis of treating children like humans. So many times I see people treating children like property, and that's just not okay. I was wondering if you can give us like a synopsis of your background and maybe your formative years and why you're so passionate about speaking up for the rights of children.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so I think like you said in your bio, I grew up irreligious. I was converted when I was 12 years old, and I spent those formative years in conservative evangelicalism. And then in my 20s and 30s, probably more intensely in my 30s, I deconstructed, which I'm sure listeners may know the meaning of that word, where just changing my mind, but then also resting myself out of that whole culture. And then at the same time, I was parenting. I had my two kids. And so I was really deconstructing and parenting at the same time. And that was very confusing because those two really impossible jobs, both are challenging. And so with the confluence of the two, I just felt like I needed support. And that's why I started the Facebook group, Raising Children Unfundamentalist. And so just with that niche focus where I wanted to talk about both parenting and faith shifting, I just delved deeper into what does it mean to treat children with justice. And at the same time, a lot of these justice conversations are happening with racism and homophobia and all these great conversations. It just seems like children is at the intersection of all of them. And there's just a lot of anti-child bias, and it's something that we don't see until we start to pay attention. And I know that it's been a learning curve for me as well. Like the more I focused on advocacy for children, the more I realized, wow, children really are invisible. And then talking about this, doing this work has also made me reflect on my own childhood. and realizing that I was fully human when I was young, but I wasn't treated as such, and what kind of trauma that did to me and how I'm recovering from it, and wanting better for the next generation. Yeah, unfortunately, all justice work is a long arc, right? So even though I've been doing this for, I don't know, almost a decade, sometimes it's still disheartening to see that things aren't getting better for children and possibly worse. That, I don't know if you saw recently, there's this viral clip of this man screaming at a crying baby, ironically. Anyway, it was just this man just chewing out this baby that was crying. And so that discourse was very disheartening for me, because where's the empathy for a baby? Just feels like that's slipping from public consciousness instead of moving towards truly including children in all public spaces.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's interesting because working with a lot of domestic violence victims, a lot of the things that are in like the wheel of power and control, or what is included as violence against women, some of those same things, with maybe the exception of like sexual abuse, can be done to children, and people don't see a problem with it. They don't see a problem with verbal abuse towards children and yelling at them. They don't often see a problem with hitting a child. They often don't see a problem with acting with this kind of sense of authority where it's just very overbearing and controlling. And it's interesting, when people get a few years older, secular society at least recognizes that's not really okay. But for some reason, when they're children, that's often seen as that the only way you can get your kids to do anything is to yell or hit or whatever.
Control.
Yeah, control. And so why do you think, or do you have any ideas? I know this is a big question, of why children aren't often seen as fully human until they reach adulthood.
Yeah, I think that's just, if you look at the history of childhood, it's very recently that children have been given the amount of respect and dignity that they've been given. Back in the day, infanticide, murdering infants was common, and it's not even considered murder. And then you move towards child labor years, where it was right and normalized for children to work in really horrible conditions. And then you move into really now, where we see children being disciplined in really harsh ways that still normalize. Spanking in schools is still legal, right, in many states in America. And really, we are still very much trying to push past this barrier of treating children as human beings. So it's, when you look back in the history, you realize where we still have a long way to go. And it's amazing when you tell people to imagine saying the things that you're saying to the kids to like saying it to your wife. And a lot of times it's just not acceptable. For instance, I don't know if this might be uncomfortable for listeners, but a lot of times parents will say, I don't allow my kids to do this. I don't allow my kids to have this much money, or I don't allow my kids this much screen time. This word allow. Imagine saying that to your wife, right? I don't allow my wife to do this. Now, I know some people do this, but it's just, there's this sense of ownership, this sense that I am in control of another human's life. We don't own our children. And I know it's tricky to talk about because we have responsibilities as parents and caregivers, but just the language that we use really still exhibits that, a sense that we have dominance over our kids. And so my hope is that we really move into more equality and a collaborative model, even with very young kids. I do want to say, when it comes to domestic violence, a lot of times, if you see men treating children very harshly in public, when I see that, I often wonder how he treats his wife. because it's the same dynamic. If you're somebody who is dominant, assertive, and controlling, that's who you're going to be with everybody. So that's one thing to kind of keep. It's a red flag. Another issue is that a lot of times women who are treated with dominance and control, they turn around and treat the children with dominance and control because they have power over them and they're powerless against their spouse. And that's also a really tragic consequence of dominance. So growing up evangelical, you have that umbrella illustration where you got God and the man, the husband, and then the wife, and then the children. So that's a very authoritarian way of forming a family and framing a family. And it's problematic because when you try to dominate someone else, it just, the violence trickles down. Yeah. And it's traumatic and it's unjust and it's extremely unhealthy.
Those are all really good points. And yeah, dominance, if it shows up in one area, it usually shows up in other areas. That's all really profound things that you're saying. I also like that you use the word having a collaborative approach between parents and children. And I love the sound of that, but I also have practical questions. So I guess this is a two-part thing. Like, what would you say collaborative parenting looks like? And then as a sub-question of that, how do you collaboratively parent a child when you're like, okay, I have to get them to school by this time. They don't want to put on their shoes. If they don't get to school on time, then I don't make it to work on time. If I don't make it to work on time, I'm fired. And that comes back on the kids. Like, how do you work in those situations where you do have to be a responsible parent without being a controlling menace?
Yeah. I think really it's I think our core philosophy and the way that we view our kids have to change. And a lot of times what we do practically may not look different, but it makes a difference in the long run. So for instance, somebody who believes their children is controlled or should be controlled is not fully human, belongs to the parent. They could just tell them to do whatever they want. They might tell a child, I don't care what you got going on. You are putting your shoes on and we're going out the door right now. And so that's one way to do it. A collaborative approach is you realize that we are a team and the family is a team. And we do need to have certain things work together so that mom and dad can get to work, so that they can pay the bills and feed the family. And that's for the benefit of the child as well. And so we need cooperation from both sides. And so in that situation, it might still end up being that the child has to do something that the child does not like. And so the end result might look similar, but the philosophy and the posture changes everything. Because for one, you can be so much more gentle, right? You can say, listen, I'm not trying to exert dominance over you. I'm not trying to tell you what to do because you just have to listen. I'm trying to encourage you to get out the door because we're a team. And you need to help me out and I'll help you out. But I can also see somebody, a parent who has a collaborative mindset, realize that a toddler cannot be hurried. They are developmentally not capable of sticking to an adult schedule. And they can maybe decide, okay, I'm going to ask my boss if I can go to school, if I can go to work a couple of hours later and maybe leave later, so that I can give my toddler that time in the morning that they need to get out the door. You know, something a little bit more dramatic like that, I can see a collaborative parent being willing to make that choice because they realize that their child is a human being. And honestly, like, a toddler needs to play. That's their job. They also have a job. And how can we help each other out? You help me do my job. I help you do your job. Do you see how that's so much more collaborative? That's viewing this child as also fully human, has needs that they need fulfilled, and as well as your own. Like, I think a lot of times we think gentle parenting is dismissing our own needs. It's not. I think gentle parents are more aware of their needs. Do you know why I know gentle parents are more aware of their own needs? It's because they honor their child's needs. When you honor someone else's needs, it's usually because you deserve to have your needs.
people who don't honor other people's needs, they're not honoring their own. They're not aware that they have needs that are unmet. That's why they lash out. That's why they yell and scream and they are dysregulated because they are not fulfilling their own tank. So this man who's yelling at the baby crying on the plane, he is not aware that he has several unmet needs from his own childhood trauma, from maybe he was not seen and heard when he was a child, because a regulated, healthy human being does not yell at a crying baby. So actually, I think gentle parents and collaborative parents are people who are most aware of their own needs, and they're constantly trying to fill their own needs, to regulate themselves so that they can be healed and whole to parent their child.
Yes, I love that. And it reminds me, my husband and I don't have kids right now, but we've had conversations about if we are to have a child, setting them up for success and we're like being cognizant of their developmental needs, because we've seen people take children to like a restaurant and it's obviously past the child's bedtime. So it makes sense that the child would be fussy and crying. And then the adults are upset at the child when it's like, you're putting a child in a circumstance that they can't control on their own. They need their sleep.
So much
and it's really on the parents.
Yeah. And
the thing is, children just don't have a lot of choice. Children don't have a lot of power. A lot of children, pre-verbal children, can't even tell you how they're feeling. So we have a home video of my son as a baby, and he was just born. Okay. This is so funny. It was like I was holding him after I just pushed him out. And his sister came over and he's like talking in his ear and he starts pouting. His lips start curling. He was sad. And we were just like, oh my gosh, look how much he loves you, honey. And it was so clear to us, you know, now looking at the video, he was being overstimulated. He had this loud toddler booming in his ear, but he was a baby and he couldn't tell us, I don't like this noise in my ear. So like pre-verbal children have so many needs that they communicate by crying. Toddlers communicate by tantrums. Preschoolers communicate by some misbehavior or behavior issues, but they're telling us what their needs are. And so a child who goes to a restaurant that's maybe too much for them. Some kids love stimulation, some kids don't. And so as parents, we really have to try to be great translators of our children, trying to figure out what are they telling us. So a child melting down at a restaurant at 8 p.m. is telling you, don't take me out at 8 p.m. And it's okay. We can't expect parents to be none of us know what's going on in another person's mind. So we can't expect parents to know that either. And that's why people in public should have more grace on parents who are taking their kids out. Like, they're learning. But yeah, to have compassion on both the parents and the children.
That makes so much sense. And I love how you have that balanced approach, because I've seen people go to one extreme or the other. Like, they focus completely on the child and they don't have any grace for the parents, or they focus completely on the parents and they don't call out any type of bad parenting styles that could harm a child. But really having this balance of like, we both have needs, this collaborative, gentle approach, I think is really beautiful. And one of the things, the ideas that I've seen a lot of times in church environments and faith environments, and those have been the ones that I've mainly seen parenting happen in, so perhaps it extends further than this, but there's often this idea, it's twofold. One is that you should be grateful to be here, and anything that you get as a child is a gift, and you should just be happy for whatever scraps are given to you, versus the parent being like, I chose to have this child, and so I have a responsibility to give them good things. But then pairing with that, there can be this idea of, from the time child is born, there's total depravity. They're evil. As a baby, I don't remember this, but I was told stories multiple times, and it was actually really humiliating. My dad told us in front of a church Sunday school class once that when I would cry as a child, they thought I was demonically possessed, and they did like an exorcism. And I think it's just so unhelpful when people have those ideas that child comes out of the womb with something evil in them, and then on top of that, anything good that they receive, they should just be grateful for the scraps, versus parents had the autonomy to bring that child into the world. In most cases, there are a few exceptions.
Well,
to
that's the thing, right? Women don't have autonomy over their bodies.
Yeah, that's true. Goals.
Yeah, I think the original sin doctrine is extremely damaging to children because it affects the way you treat the baby. If you think a baby's crying because they're depraved, you're going to try to exorcise a demon out of them. You're going to try to let them cry it out. You're going to discipline, even spank a baby. There's extremely ignorant of a child's normal development. Baby, you need to be tending to their every cry. That's what they need. They're crying because they need your comfort and they need to be fed or changed. And then that just goes on as toddler and preschooler and school age and teenager kids, like having this idea that humans are sinful is going to impact the way a parent parents a child. And it's in the most damaging way, if you believe that they're inherently wicked and sinful, as opposed to they have needs that need to be met and they are figuring out who they are and learning. So it makes all the difference, that one single ideology, theology. So yes, I'm very anti-original sin. And this idea that children should be grateful to be here. I feel like I'm always apologizing for bringing my children into this world with all its struggles. Like, I chose to do this to you. No, yes, babies did not have a choice to come into this world. We didn't have a choice to be born into the family that we were born into. And I harp on this point often. Babies, children do not have a lot of power. And I don't say this the reason that I say it is so that we are very conscious of power dynamics, that we're always very conscious of how much power we have over children. And I don't think even the most gentlest parents can equalize that power. It's hard because if a child is this tall, just in physical stature, we have more power and we can't change that. And so we have to almost overcompensate for that power differential. But yes, being conscious of it is a huge thing. And so I'm always saying they don't have power. They didn't choose to be here. They don't get to choose so many things. There are so many things that are powerless to them. They don't have money. So yeah, it's hard. It's hard being a child. Let's try to support them as much as we can.
Yeah, I love that so much. And it's such a deviation from the mainstream narrative that's out there, both in religious communities, but also honestly in secular communities as well. There's just very few people talking about children in this sense. And that's what I really love and appreciate about your work. I've got a couple other questions. And one is just, we talked about some of the toxic ideology around fundamentalist parenting, whether it's the control, the authoritarianism, violent parenting, those kinds of things. Okay, so when you think of what the ideals would be for parenting, if you could place those before us, what would be ideal in your mind, knowing that nobody hits the ideal, perfection doesn't exist, but what do you think in an ideal world the relationship between a parent and child would look like? What are parents really here to do on behalf of their children?
I love that question. Yeah, I think that we are here to hold witness to our child's becoming. So like I was saying before, you know how I said we have to become really good translators for our children's needs? So I think the moment that our babies are born, they're trying to tell us who they are. First, they communicate their needs, right? A baby cries for milk and to be changed. But then as they get older, they're telling us, this is who I am. This is what I like. And this is what I don't like. This is what I think. These are my ideas. This is how I believe. And I think as a parent, our job and privilege and joy, really, it is to listen and learn and to be a part, participate in their becoming. So that's the main job.
of course, we have responsibilities to feed and clothe them and to meet their needs. And that is our job because we chose to have them. Like, they are entitled. Like, children are literally supposed to be entitled to these things because we chose to bring them. We chose to give them life. And so, yeah, we have our responsibility. We have our obligations to meet their needs. But beyond that, I think that we have this joy of getting to know these small human beings and then developing a relationship with them and eventually, hopefully, become good friends. And I feel like there's always this debate in parenting circles is, oh, are you supposed to be your child's friend? And whatever, I don't really care that much about that debate. But I do think that especially when your children become adults, like that is a relationship that they don't need you anymore. And so it's a very much a consensual desire to stay in relationship with you. And I think that's friendship.
I love that. And even still, that gives like that room for autonomy with the child. It's not the expectation that your adult children would want to stay in your company. It's the mutual friendship that you hopefully develop. Because I think that goes into so many other toxic conversations. One of the last interviews that I did, we talked about this expectation of, oh, you can't remove relationship from your parents because they're blood. If there's a toxic thing happening, that's not safe for you. And I think instead, if we shift the conversation into parents ideally will create an environment where their children grow up safe and healthy and where there's this relationship that morphs, like you said, into a friendship where there's this genuine desire to be in connection, not an automatic assumption based on I brought you into this world and so I deserve this. And it's just so much more quality based. And I love, love, love that you are talking about this.
It's just more authentic, right?
Yeah.
It's that you want a real relationship. You don't want a forced relationship just because of a title. Yeah.
That's such a good point that I hadn't even thought of. I think there are a lot of people who are in relationship with their parents simply because they share DNA and there's a title versus actually wanting to be with them. And like, how sad is that to be in a relationship with somebody where it's this feeling of, I have to be here. That's not authentic. And so I love that you brought that forward. One last question is, what advice would you give to parents who maybe they are leaving fundamentalism and they're in the middle of their parenting process? And maybe the beginning of their parenting, they were very fundamentalist. They were very authoritarian. Maybe they made some decisions with parenting their children that they're not proud of anymore. What encouragement would you give to them about making that healthier transition and approaching this change with their children? What would you say to that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So we know that good parenting or connected parenting, like every other relationship, I think it's not different from other relationships, is like 99% repair. Right? It's not about getting it right at the first time. I think it's just like the whole taking your kids out to a restaurant at 8 p.m. Maybe that was a mistake, but you learn from that and you repair, right? So I think that's how I would view parents who raise their children fundamentalists in the beginning. I did as well. And I have a lot of regrets about that. And I think it's important for us to, I don't think remorse is a bad thing. It's good to be remorseful of, let's say, if I spank my kids, I think it's a good thing that I'm remorseful of that. But then to not get stuck in that, because eventually you're just going to become a burden to your children if you're like constantly apologizing to them and constantly saying, I'm so sorry. You're making it about you. So feel your feelings and move past it and don't continue to harm yourself. Don't continue to shame yourself and do better. And that's what we're always doing as human beings, right? Like we're always hopefully learning and doing better and evolving. And so it doesn't matter if you grew up fundamentalist or not, or if you started off being a fundamentalist and then you're not anymore. It's not like
all of a sudden you're going to be excellent and perfect. No, you're still learning and growing. And we continue to learn as more information, especially about child development, comes to light. We're always learning. And so I think people who have that those fundamentalist roots, in a way, is our advantage because we already know how to repair, right? We've already deconstructed and know how to move through the shame of past mistakes, of trying to do better. And so we need to keep doing that. That is how we grow. And yeah, it's really more important to connect with your kids than to apologize to death to them. Apologize, do the repair, then enjoy life with your kids. Enjoy connectedness with your children. So that's what I would say.
That makes so much sense because apologies are important. But like you said, when we do it almost to a point of where it's overkill, it does shift it away from the person we're apologizing to and more to our own guilt and the things we should be working on for ourselves. And instead, apologizing, repairing, doing better, and finding joy, like that really is so beautiful. And I wish more people would follow that process.
Yeah. I really like talking about delighting in our kids because there's something so life-giving about somebody who just delights in you. If a child walks into a room and then their parents' eyes light up and they're just like so excited to see them and just want to be in their presence, that sense of delight, I feel, is just transformative and is healthy and beautiful. Yeah, as much as I talk about recovering from religious trauma and being justice oriented, like all these really serious and intense issues, what I would really love is for parents to develop this capacity to delight in your kids. And really, it's not that hard. All you have to do is what I've been saying is to listen and to see your kid for exactly who they are. If you do that, it just won't be hard because your children are delightful. There are. I run a huge parenting group. So I have parents talk about their children all the time. And usually it's because their children is having some sort of misbehavior, right? Oh, please help. My child is tantruming nonstop. My child won't get out the door. My child is bullying other kids at school. And when they tell their story, they always say, but my child is loving and kind and caring, or but my child is sweet. And there's always, you can see it, that there is something wonderful about this child, even though they're struggling, right? And I just love reading between those lines, between the lines of the struggle that they're having with their children, because I'm like, because it's easier for somebody who's not the parent. Parents, you're in the thick of it. You're having to deal with the issues. You're the one that has to deal with the problems. And so always is the problem sometime. But when you're not the parent and you're like, oh man, this child is adorable. Even when they're tantruming, they're adorable. Like, I think it's very easy for me to see that when I see other kids. I was like, this child is trying to communicate something in this beautiful, revolutionary way, flailing his arms about. I can see that. And I guess I just want parents to really develop that eye as well, to see outside of their circumstances, to just step back and see the whimsy and the just how hilarious it is to be actively parenting oftentimes, and just to get that different perspective and infuse the sense of delight into parenting, I think is, yeah, a really worthy goal for your parenting life.
The first time I remember anybody truly delighting in me that way was when I met my husband, and seeing him light up when I walk into a room. And even when I'm having one of my anxiety or depression days, I can still see he looks on me even when I'm having a bad time or a hard time with joy and excitement. And I just think about how formative that would have been if I had felt that growing up as a child, how much less trauma I would have experienced. Yeah. And how much more confident my life would have been if I'd felt that from a very young age. And I'm so grateful for it now. But it took me years and years to get there. And so really sharing that with parents as somebody who didn't feel that way, I can tell you that would have made a difference in my life. And so I know what you're saying is the truth. And I think that's really gonna help a lot of parents gain perspective. The last question I want to ask you, and it's something that we just ask everybody, it's fun. What does courage mean to you?
Okay. Wow, that's a really big question. What does courage mean? Is it really cliche and unoriginal to say courage is to just be unapologetically yourself?
So good. So good.
Yeah, because oftentimes we think of courage as people who do really brave things like get in front of a bullet or or are extraordinarily gifted in one way or another and all these things. But really, there are so many people who are introverted, who prefer to be quiet, who are mediocre. They're not that great at anything. I think of myself like that, like I'm just a mediocre person. But I think being myself in whatever context I'm in is really courageous. And I think that's true because I've had to fight to be this way, to be myself. And even though the results may be unassuming, it feels courageous to me.
That is so good. So good. And I don't see you as mediocre at all. I'm constantly impressed by what you're putting out and I feel like it's revolutionary work, but I do love that definition. And I know people are going to want to find your books and find you on social media. We've talked about your Facebook groups. Tell people how they can get connected with your work after the show.
Yeah, everything is on my website, CindyWongBrand.com. But I have a couple of books. I have a parenting book. I have a children's book, which you can see right here. I can't point in the...
Oh, yeah, I see it on your shelf. I love that.
Called You Are Revolutionary. And I have a membership called Parenting After Religious Trauma that people can join. Lots of resources. It's all on my website, CindyWongBrand.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Cindy. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. I appreciate you being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And hey, everyone, after you're done following Cindy, checking out her books, all the things, please go ahead and follow Courage365 and all of our social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, TikTok, all the places. We also have a website, courage365.org, with a bunch of free resources that you can download and access instantly. We have a Need Help tab if you're in a crisis situation. And one of my favorite resources for you is our text message list. We send out daily inspirational text messages Monday through Friday. These are text messages written by survivors for survivors. They're empowering, inspiring. We don't spam you. Your number's not shared with other people. But we have had such amazing feedback, people telling us that this has really changed the course of their day. Or even the course of their life. We've had people who are in some really dark times, and these texts are things that they cling to for encouragement and inspiration in the morning. You can, of course, join our free Facebook group where we have a lot more conversations like this. Please reach out if you have any questions. And thank you so much for tuning in. If you know somebody who would be inspired by this conversation, please go ahead and share it. That always helps us out. And as always, live with courage.